Okay. So, Professor Condor, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. As we've discussed ahead of the interview, the purpose of this discussion is to go over the period during which replica symmetry breaking was formulated and developed in physics. But to get to that, I have a few background questions that I'd like to go through. In
Yes.
particular, in notes that you sent us ahead of this interview, you mentioned that you hesitated between pursuing a career in piano and one in physics. Can you first review what led you to be interested in physics and then to choose physics over music?
Well, I was interested in many things, too many, possibly. At an early age, something like 12, I had this very remarkable teacher of chemistry at school who created a fantastic enthusiasm, not only in me, but basically in the whole class. It must have been a very remarkable person. I am not able to recall any specific trick he used. Some years later, I had a chat with my ex-classmates and asked him what the secret might have been. And the guy hesitated and then, after a certain while, said that he was an authentic person. Now, you have to understand the weight of such a description, because that was the 50s in Hungary, a full-fledged Stalinist terror. So, now, to be an authentic person as a teacher, that is no trivial achievement under those conditions. So that might have been part of the magic. And the guy was did not even have a diploma or a degree, so that just curiosity, we went to university simultaneously. So he was under some sort of punishment because he was coming from a bad sort of family, an enemy of the people, or that sort of thing, and therefore, he was prevented from going to university. And as it happened, we got admitted together. But he knew a lot, so that's for sure. He knew a lot about physics and chemistry, and he fed all kinds of textbooks to me, including this university textbook. And I regarded those as somehow holding the secret to creation, that type of childish picture. And I really took them seriously, so that I took notes out of those 800 pages book. And taking notes, you are young, your memory is working fine, so that taking notes, I learned the whole thing. And it helped me a lot during my university years, because I had this intimate relationship to different materials, elements, salts, whatever. And that was kind of unique among my classmates at university, who, being physicists, look down at chemistry as sort of like a bad sort of kitchen work. And so that I was regarded an expert on the basis of something which I learned at the age of 12. And also, I had this key experience of building experiments and checking that they work out as expected. Not automatically, you had to pay attention to details. Nevertheless, I had this little laboratory, and it was very reassuring. It's more than reassuring. It was a revelation that there is one segment in life where this universal lie, which was all over the country, was not present, and you could trust what you read. It was a fantastic experience, I would say. And later I found out that many of my colleagues in Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, many of my colleagues were motivated by the same sort of feeling. So this may be behind the brilliance of Soviet physics.
I see. So you chose physics over music. Music also does not lie, by the way.
Yes. Well, first, I was not good enough. That was rather clear to me. And besides, I found music to be an emotional burden. So, a Beethoven sonata is a high drama. And if you take it seriously, then it does have an impact on you. And I did not necessarily want to spend my life, under this constant emotional pressure.
Fair enough. You pursued a diploma thesis specifically in theoretical solid state physics or condensed matter physics at the time. What drew you to
that? Many body problems, I would say. It was not solid state. It was a liquid helium related or condensed Bose system or whatever. Yes?
Yes, so what drew you to that topic?
Well, first, I found superfluidity mesmerizing. So it was a very interesting phenomenon. And the person who was involved in that type of research at the theoretical physics department at Tush University, he was a very serious scientist, very he was not a showman. His lectures were, I would even say, somewhat boring, but he paid so conscientious attention to detail, and he was able to make us understand all this stuff. Yeah, anybody, theory is a technical subject, so that you have to learn a lot, in second quantization and all that stuff. And he convinced me that this is a guy who takes himself seriously and takes his subject seriously, so that I decided to join him or ask for a research subject from him. By the way, the first thing he gave me was not related to bosons, but fermions, Friedel oscillation and that type of thing. And this overscreening, if you know what it is, the overscreening was the random phase approximation produces an effective distribution of the charge density, where more charges are chased away from the neighborhood of a mine ion than the actual density existing around the time. Now, and we made some progress, but I was not happy with it. I thought it would make a thesis, but a trivial one. So that we changed subject rather late and ended up with this problem whose first the first appearance in the literature was due to Gavorie and Nozière, and a proof of the collective excitation spectrum and the one particle excitation spectrum in condensed Bose systems. And my thesis advisor had this suspicion that this is not just something which is valid at zero temperature in the long wavelength limit, but it may be due to the existence of condensates, so that it may be true all over the condensed phase. And he posed this problem, and I managed to extend this theorem of Gavorie and Nozière, and later it even became a paper. So that,
So if I understand correctly, after that, you didn't have to do a PhD thesis, right? That was is that correct?
Well, it has its own story. PhD, as it is understood in the West, or as it is understood now also in Hungary, that sort of PhD did not exist. There was a doctorate which a university was able to confer on you, but it was not really much more than the doctorate of a lawyer or a medical doctorate. So it's some embellishment to your name, sort of, but it was very cheap to get it. Nevertheless, I decided to get such a title, but in order to be able to submit your application for a title like that, you needed the support of the local Communist Party. And I happened to be on bad terms with the party secretary, and he told me that he would not support this. And since the whole thing did not really have any kind of significance, I just decided not to bother about it. But parallel with this, university given doctorate, we also had this Soviet system of scientific titles or degrees or whatever, the candidate of sciences and the doctor of sciences. That was given by the Academy of Science. It was much more serious. So that by the time you got a candidate, the stupid name, a candidate of science degree, you had to have something like a dozen papers to your name at least. And in order to get the doctor of sciences degree, you had to have some students, some school around you, and become a full professor. So that I got those from the Academy of Sciences. And when the political change came at the beginning of the 90s, they decided that a candidate of sciences, and even more the doctor of sciences, implied the PhD. So that I have a piece of paper, but frankly, I never had a proper PhD.
I see. So as you were not a trainee, as one would have at least in a PhD program today, how did you choose research questions after your diploma thesis?
Well, I had this thesis advisor on the master's level, and he, right when I got the graduation, he went to the US and became a member of Richard Ferrell's group, who introduced the dynamical scaling hypothesis. And when he returned to Hungary, and when I was able to get a position at the same department where he was working, I joined him and we tried to do some work on dynamical scaling. But the microscopic theory of dynamical scaling is quite complicated because the vertices in contrast to the scale, static scale. The vertices tend to have singularities due to hydrodynamic modes. And we did not take that into account, so that most of what we did on dynamic scaling was more or less nonsensical. But then I decided to calculate critical indices within the framework of the von Oberon expansion. And that decision was motivated first to be independent of my previous thesis advisor. And second, critical indices were supposed to be universal so that you did not need a day-to-day contact with the laboratory. You were after a universal number. And so I had first one student and later more. And together with them, we calculated Feynman graphs up to six loops, which is a pretty hard job, I would say. We did the calculation by hand, you understand? Mm-hmm. There were 75 different Feynman diagrams to evaluate. So it took some sweat. And we pushed it just to the second order, 1/n². But we had to calculate Feynman graphs going up to the six loop level. And we had to use all kinds of fancy regularization tricks, Mellin transforms and dimensional regularization, and also this trick which I learned from Kurt Szymancyk and Giorgio Parisi, conform invariant integration. Conform invariance imposes some structure on the propagators, and if you have an irreducible Feynman diagram, which does not have self energy insertions and nothing like that, it's just an irreducible one, then you can reduce the number of loops via this trick. And the trick was due to De Ramo, Parisi, and Pelliti. And Kurt Szymancyk took the pain to write me by hand a long, long letter showing that one of the graphs which we evaluated can be done much simpler via this technique. It was a fantastic gesture. Just imagine, you know, the guy was world famous and a big authority, and I was a nobody. And he took the time and effort to write a 12-page long handwritten letter explaining how the result which I derived can be obtained much easier. That was impressive. And in 78, I also met Giorgio the first time.
Before we jump to that, I wanted to first talk about your first crossing of the Iron Curtain, I think, which to go to the ICTP in 1972. How important was that experience for you scientifically and personally? And sort of the corollary to this is, how isolated was the theoretical physics community in Hungary before you were able to travel?
Well, the Iron Curtain started to have some holes in it, so that some people could go to the US on a Ford scholarship, like my thesis advisor. Also, there was contact with Vienna University in high energy physics. And people were allowed to go for one single day for a seminar in Vienna. And in fact, the first time I crossed the Iron Curtain was on the occasion of such a seminar. So I spent one day in Vienna. And then there was a summer school in Kiljava, Finland, the north of Helsinki. And they graciously allowed me to take part. That was in 71. But that was a short visit, so 10 days or something. And I did not have really any money at all. So that my main memory of that school, that I was starving. We were swimming in the lake. We were having these endless sauna sessions, but I could not buy one piece of bread or anything. So that was an interesting, and nevertheless, it was an interesting school. And that was where I first heard about Kenneth Wilson's Renormalization Group papers. And I have to tell you that those two FISREF papers were so convincing that everybody at the school was convinced that the guy would pick up a Nobel Prize for them. So we all knew about the renormalization group, but it was like some sort of a black magic. And Wilson sort of filled it up with content, with physical content, the physical picture behind it. And all of a sudden, everybody was able to understand the basic idea. And with that knowledge, we went back to the original papers, Bogoyev and Shirin. Those old guys must have understood perfectly what they were doing. It was their audience who did not understand. And it took Wilson to make it a revelation. Now, any case, that happened in Helsinki. And the next winter, at the beginning of 72, I was allowed to go to the ICTP for a longer period. I think it was 3 or 4 month winter school. And that was directed by John Simon and Norman March. It was on theoretical solid state. And that's where I, for example, made the acquaintance of Jona Lasinio. Jona Lasinio was a big name. And he invited me to Padova. He was at Padova at that time. And I gave a seminar, we had a chat, etc. So that was again some sort of an uplifting experience. And I went to visit Rome University, La Sapienza, and I visited Ferdinando De Pasquale, Carlo Di Castro. And I did not meet Giorgio because he was working at Frascati and he was very young. So that at that point, I did not meet him. But these were the first international contacts I had.
I see. So I understand that so you were mentioning your first meeting with Giorgio, and that you had already started to correspond with him ahead of time. So can you tell me a bit how it is that you got to interact with Giorgio and then to meet him?
Well, there was a conference in Hungary. And although it was on field theory or something which was outside direct experience, nevertheless, I learned that Giorgio would come, and I went to the conference in order to meet with him, because by that time I learned from Kurt Szymanczyk that Giorgio was one of the authors of this Deramo Parisi Pelliti paper, and I wanted to have a chat with him because by that time we had most of the Feynman graphs evaluated, 75 of them or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and Giorgio turned out to be extremely open and very helpful. We had a long, long discussion. He was teaching me all the secrets of this conformal invariant integration. So that that was the first meeting. And the correspondence came much later when I was in Frankfurt.
Okay.
And where I was doing some attempts to derive an alternative symmetry breaking scheme to his.
So speaking of which, you mentioned in your notes that you first heard about replica symmetry breaking from a talk by Robin Sinchcom at a MECO meeting, right? In March 78.
Yes.
So was that your first introduction to spin glasses as well?
That was the first time I even heard about them.
Okay. So can you tell us a bit more about, I mean, was this an important talk or was this just one of many? Did you?
Well, it was important from the point of view that he was talking about the Edwards Anderson model. He was talking about the Almeida Talus instability and necessarily about replicas. And well, to be frank, I found this idea of making analytic continuation from a discrete set of integers to the reals, I found this absurd. Now, of course, there are additional constraints under which the analytic continuation is unique, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the sufficient condition is called the Carlson theorem. It tells about the necessary structure of the set over which the function is defined, so that it has to have an accumulation point. All right, the integers have an accumulation point at infinity, so that that was met. But it also puts a limit on the type of divergence the function may have along this set. And it should not be faster than exponential. Whereas in the case of replicas, it was e to the n squared, right? So that it violated the sufficient condition. On top, there were necessary conditions, right? Like monotonicity and convexity and that type of thing. Richard Palmer and von Hammen did work on this. And so it seemed to me arbitrary. Right? So you just write up a formula and you decide that the formula is valid on the reals, whereas the formula is written up on the integers. So I was not surprised at all to learn that it did not work. So there was this instability. And this was one of the, this was the first experience of mine with spin glasses. The second came in 79 at this Trieste conference, where Giorgio displayed a poster. Now that poster was a very peculiar one. It was just two pages torn from a copybook with some scribble on them. And he was very late to submit that to the organizer. So that's why he was given this high position of presenting a poster. Now, in any case, I listened to his explanation, and my impression of replicas became even worse as a result. So evidently, I could not understand the considerations behind. And as I may have written to you later, I was putting some moral pressure on Giorgio to write up the considerations that led him to that replica symmetry breaking scheme. Because normally people regard it as a flash of intuition or something, but that's not quite sure. He did have an array of experiences from high energy physics to quantum chemistry, because the replica trick also comes up in the theory of polymers. It comes up in the theory of cyclic molecules and that sort of thing. And he used all that information in formulating this outlandish idea about the structure of replica symmetry breaking. Well, I did not get the point in 79, so that first real engagement with spin glasses came in Frankfurt.
So, but did that motivate you to start following the literature, or that also came later?
No, I was doing percolation theory and all kinds of other disordered systems, but spin glasses, I started to learn them in Frankfurt in 71.
In 81, yes.
81, yeah.
You moved to work in Saclay after your time in Frankfurt, and you started collaborating with Cyrano de Dominicis. Did you know Cyrano ahead of going to Saclay? Or
yes. That again has a background story of it. In 78, I wanted to attend the Lesus School on ill matter. This was the school which Bernard Derrida was mentioning in his interview. And it was a key event for the whole community. So that I submitted my application, which was accepted by Roger Ballion. But at the last moment, a special unit of the intelligence or something, intelligence services, suddenly discovered that school was being sponsored by NATO. And they came to me, it was a Saturday, and the phone rang and told me that, Comrade Condor, we are a loosened up country already, but we have not yet sunken so deep as to accept sponsorship from NATO. It triggered a fantastic scandal because all the people who overlooked this NATO label and who forwarded my application up along the chain, all those people were very severely reprimanded. So, well, my boss at the Theoretical Physics Institute wanted to intervene because this guy from the Minister of the Interior said that if the Hungarian state finds your participation in the school important, they will find the means to pay for your scholarship. So that my boss went to the Deputy Minister of Education and said that, okay, I think it's an important, please come up with the money. And even before telling my name, the guy was, oh, I know, Lesus NATO Kondo. So that was the last association I wanted to be involved in. In any case, so I was forbidden to go there. And in 79, there was a conference in Hungary, and Cyrano was one of the participants. And I told him about this adventure of mine. And he decided to help me, so that he produced a fake invitation to Saclay for the summer of 1980, so that I can go to Paris, take the flight for Warsaw to Ajaccio, and take part in the Gorsky School. Mm. Now, so this was, now you have to know that Cyrano was a deep convinced communist, but he was not particularly enthusiastic about the form of communism which was practiced in Eastern Europe, so that he was very kind of helping me to get into contact with the Saclay group. And this is what I really wanted to do, because we were involved in this one over an expansion, and Edward Brezen and Hikami were doing a one over an expansion and some other, and also all kinds of other very high level field theoretic work was coming out from Saclay. So that I regarded the Saclay group as the pinnacle of European science in that field. And therefore I was desperate to come into contact with them, and Cyrano helped me to do this. So this was our previous contact.
I see. Okay, in 1982, you went to Saclay and you started to collaborate more explicitly with Cyrano. Can you give us a bit the scientific context and of that project, and what did your previous work prepare you to attack?
Well,
these questions.
My previous work was to learn the Parisi replica center breaking scheme. So already in Frankfurt, I came to the conclusion that this must be where the solution lies to this whole riddle. And I decided to make an effort to understand it in depth. So that I recalculated the first papers of Georges, the first four, I think, or five. Which was a non-trivial thing, because some of them were Fizerev letters, so some sporadic information. Besides, some of the equations were wrong, you know, infested with typos, except the last ones. So this was a fantastic experience. You know, you are trying to use those equations which are being published as stepping stones. But it turns out that the stepping stones are very slippery and you find yourself in the water. But by the time you fight your way down the road up to the last one, turns out that that was solid and trustable. So this is the way Georgia is working. So, yeah, okay, so I recalculated these papers and I got fascinated, to say the least. I got fascinated by this sort of approach to theoretical physics, that instead of laying down the groundwork, deciding which concepts, which rules of the game to use, you focus on the physical ideas you have to express, and you create the tools for that. And this I found immensely deep and interesting. Perhaps it's a hyperbole to bring here the case of the prediction of the positron, but this sort of gesture or this sort of approach to a problem, which George used, reminded me of Paul Dirac's approach, where he had four positive numbers, he wanted to take the root, the square root of that expression such that the result is linear in the four things under the square root. Now, he did not ask the question whether this has a solution within the framework of usual complex numbers or whatever. He asked the question, what is the space, what is the minimum space where I can implement such a trick? I think this is the main difference between mathematics and great theoretical physics. You don't necessarily play the game correctly. You know, you are subtracting infinitely large quantities and coming up with something which agrees with the laboratory experiment to 10 or 12 digits. And later, some other people of lesser intelligence work out the details and convince the rest of humanity that that trick was all right. But I don't know if I can express myself properly, but I found this sort of approach to theoretical physics immensely exciting. Or surely it was a clear mathematics. I mean, it's not only that zero by zero matrices, everybody was mentioning that, but to get there, you had to go through metric spaces of indefinite metric, where the scalar product or the length of a vector can be negative and that sort of thing. So anything that you have in your mind, the picture of geometry, gets completely upended. Well, so I found it interesting and a challenge, and I decided that the next logical step would be to see if this instability was present or not. And Cyrano had the same conviction, so that it was very natural for us to join forces.
So do you know what had drawn Cyrano to spinning glasses on his own? Did you discuss that with him?
Well, he came to all this via dynamics. You see, there was always a trend in spin glass physics that somehow replicas have to do with dynamics. André Blondin wrote a fairly cryptic paper in which he formulated this assumption. And it took another decade or even more when Jorge Hurchan and Letizia Cogliandolo put up a dynamic theory and could see how it can be mapped onto replicas. But back at the beginning of the 80s, it was not clear at all, but Cyrano was convinced that this whole phenomenon was of a dynamical nature, which it is, and therefore it requires a dynamical approach. So that his first contributions to spin glass theory were dynamical equations. And together with Thomas Garel and Gabé, I think, they wrote a paper where they derived the Sompolinsky solution to the mean field theory of spin glass. The solution provided by Sompolinsky and Cipelli. He was also trying to count the number of solutions of the top equations. So that, he was well equipped. All that I knew was coming from my experience with George's solution and my own failed attempts to go beyond that, which I still did back in Frankfurt. Now, so I arrived and there was this very liberal and liberating experience in Saclay that you were not told what to do, but you were allowed to go around and look for collaboration. And you cannot do this now, because now there are grants assigned to a leading scientist, and the leading scientist recruiting collaborators. And he's underwriting the check, so that, if you sign up, you are signed up to a certain subject and a certain person. But back in those times, the lab was funded by CEOA, and they did not need to fight for grants. Remarkably, they were top-notch, even without that competition. And therefore, I arrived and they told me, okay, you look around in the corridor and you decide whom to join. And this is how I decided to join Cyrano, because by that time I was sure that the next important problem in spin glass theory is to check the stability of the Parisi solution.
So how was the reaction to that work by the burgeoning spin glass community at that point?
Well, the first reaction was from the editor of Physical Letters, who could not see the point. And therefore we bounced back. It came out in these rapid communications, but Cyrano was really mad about it. So much less important works were published in Physical Letters. So never mind. Then there was the reaction of the people in Saclay. I gave a seminar in April, I think. That was just when we finished the stability analysis. And of course, nobody could understand the details, but their attitude or the reception was extremely encouraging. You know, you have people like Claudie Cixous or Edouard Brezin or Jean-Sébastien Stengel, and people of this caliber sitting in the audience and at least pretending to appreciate your work. So it was tremendously encouraging. Then there was this Lesus Summer School, which was directed by Jean-Bernard Zuber. And although it was not on a subject in which I was involved in any degree, but I asked him for his permission to go there for a couple of days in order to meet Giorgio. And he agreed, Zuber, I mean. And I went to Lesus and had this long discussion in the chalet which Giorgio and family were renting there. Now, that summer school took place between our finishing the work on the stability and after my short visit to London. I went to see Peter Young and David Sherrington at the Imperial, also Tony Leggett in Brighton. And I was telling them about this effort of ours and the result of the stability analysis. And I also gave a talk in Les Ouches with Giorgio in the audience, so that we had a meaningful interaction there. And in London, I learned about Peter Young's, Mackenzie and Peter Young's measurements of the distribution of barrier heights. The importance of that measurement is the fact that that was the first explicit statement about the emergence of macroscopic barriers. Everybody knew there were barriers. You could not go to a spin glass seminar without people dutifully, you know, drawing a romantic landscape. That was commonplace. But Peter and Mackenzie attached some quantitative measure to that. Now, the exponents they came up with were not good. So later it turned out that the details were wrong. Nevertheless, the idea that those barriers are macroscopic was an important one. And as far as I can recall, I was the first person to inform Giorgio about this. I did not fully understand the significance of this. But you know, if you have macroscopic barriers, then it means that ergodicity is completely destroyed. Now the system is fragmented into ergodic components. And this is what Giorgio was able to take out immediately, and this is what led him to the interpretation of Q of X. It's maybe ridiculous. Nevertheless, I think to be the postman of that message, to convey that message, was an important function. And Giorgio acknowledged that much. There is this acknowledgement at the end of that paper. And then I went back, did some other work on, did the stability analysis of the Sompolinsky solution as well, and all kinds of other things. And then at the end of the year, I returned to Budapest. Our collaboration with Cyrano was kept up, so that we were exchanging letters, you know, ordinary letters delivered by post and written by hand. And we started to derive, not only the eigenvalues, but the eigenvectors and the inverse of the stability matrix, so the propagators. Now, at that point, Cyrano was using a technique which was completely unknown to me. It was so much unknown that I could not even understand it fully from his letters. So that I decided to take an alternative route and produce the same propagators via a technique that you would use in inverting any big matrix, the primitive and long route, where Cyrano was able to find some crosslinks or some shortcuts, which I was not able to follow. But I would say that this was rather characteristic of our collaboration all through the times. Now, we were collaborating for 18 years, it's a lot of time. And, you know, this is a very strange sort of collaboration. He was very quick and very prone to make mistakes. Small mistakes, factors of two. But those are the most vicious one because you are not able to figure out where a factor two can have been lost. You know, a factor pi would be much better. But therefore, he insisted upon doing this calculation in front of the blackboard. I really hated that because if you do such a calculation, you have such length on the blackboard and you make a small trivial mistake somewhere, there is no way you are able to go back and find the origin of the mistake. So that what we ended up with was a solution like this. Each morning we would meet, we would decide what to do during the day, would agree on the notation and go our separate ways. And at the end of the afternoon, we would compare notes. Now, this is a very strange sort of collaboration. Nevertheless, in the given context, it might even have been the proper method because those equations were extremely complicated. And systems of 14 integral equations. So that type of thing. And each of them so long that we could not use normal paper, but we were using this scrap paper that was coming out from the line printers. You still remember that? Mike Moore was sort of mentioning this mm-hmm. in his interview, that we started to use those because you know, most of the mistakes you make originate from turning the page and copying the last equation to the next page. And if you have a larger piece of paper, you don't need to turn the page that much. Besides, it was a Leporello, right? So that you did not need to turn the page at all. And well, I remember when I arrived in Saclay, had a chat with Bernard Derrida. And he told me that, you know, there are people in this lab who are able to do 50 pages of algebra without a mistake. So this is a standard against which you have to measure yourself. Now, it was bloody serious. You know? If you picture Edvard Brezin or Jean-Singer Stanner, they are the people who are able to do a calculation without a mistake, 50 pages. Now, it turned out that I was also able to do 50 pages without a mistake. Otherwise, we never would have come to the end of this stability analysis and inverting the Hessian matrix. Have this very objective measure of becoming more and more stupid with age, because the number of pages without a mistake I'm able to do now is 2. So there is a quantitative measure. There's no argument about it. One is getting stupid. It's, well, I also would like to mention that the general atmosphere in Saclay was both challenging and very friendly. So that there were people who were frightened by figures like Edvard Brezin or Isaacson or Jean-Zistin. Extremely intelligent, extremely quick, very dedicated people. They can inspire some old people. For example, in Elizabeth Gardner, they did inspire this sort of she was not frightened, but she was an extremely shy person. And this was the major factor for which she decided to change subject. She arrived in Saclay with non-Abelian gauge theories in the background and with the recommendation of David Wallace from Edinburgh. So that it would have been, in fact, it was very natural for her to join Claude Isaacson. And yet she was looking for someone else. And we had this, you know, foreigners, you know, in an extremely high level laboratory. Everybody is more clever than you are. So that sort of situation. So we got along very well. And she consulted me about this problem that she would like to change subject, but doesn't know whom to join. I suggested she joins Bernard Derrida because Bernard has the really fantastic ability of formulating a very simple looking problem, which is at the same time very deep. And I thought that a clever girl like Elizabeth could join such a person because, you know, the questions Bernard was asking were almost elementary. You need to know the concept of free energy and the temperature. Well, more or less, that was the introductory knowledge you needed to. And yet he was able to grasp extremely complicated and deep problems. I found that very impressive, and I thought that Elizabeth would find a good source of information, inspiration, and she did. So that was a very fruitful collaboration.
Did you stay in touch after you left Saclay, or through the years after that, or this was really just this moment?
With Elizabeth?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
No. When they turned to neural nets and the storage capacity of the perceptron and things like that, I decided to switch off because I thought that if we lose focus on this field theory problem, then it would be totally hopeless to make any progress at all. So that I really wanted to stay within this extremely sharply defined subject. With Elizabeth, you know, everybody has this trouble of conscience of the survivor vis-a-vis her. She died very young, and she was really brilliant and an extremely kind person. So that, well, it was really, I met her in London some years later, but by that time she was already ill. She never talked about it, but looking back, it's clear that she was very ill. Okay. What else can I say?
I was going to take you up to Manchester, but if there's something else you wanted to say about Saclay.
Yes. I started to say that it was very challenging and friendly. For example, they had Mehta there of random matrix theory fame. And he was an extremely interesting personality, very friendly, and he enjoyed looking like a clochard. So he was almost provoking the environment, so people who did not know him, to display their racist attitudes, and then shaming them by revealing that it was a professor, a world famous scientist. Now, I liked him very much, and I enjoyed his stories. And whenever he saw me in the afternoon going along the corridor, would come out. So, oh, come, I have a nice problem for you. And he pulled me into his office and, you know, wrote on the blackboard some Ramanujan-like identity. So, look, can you prove this? I could not, but I took a copy and worked it out in the night at home, which was only fueling his next attempt. Come on, I have another and a very nice identity for you. So then Jacques Descloison. I had one of the reflectors and I had to change it. Jacques heard about this and told me that, okay, I have a workshop in my garage. Why don't you come over and we can fix it together? Turned out to take 4 hours. Okay? We were all covered in dirt and oil, but the car was resuscitated. And then we went up from the garage. It turned out it was a smallish castle. Right? With his ancestors' pictures on the wall and the period furniture and that sort of thing. So Druff helped me tuning the car because some stupid mechanic screwed up the ignition. What are those called? The sparks?
Spark plugs.
Yes. So the guy permuted them and then the car was vehemently objecting so that we had to retune. And well, displaying very friendly attitudes and real acceptance, I would say. I liked being there. And on my part, I was not afraid of their being too clever because I always liked the company of people who were much more clever than I am. So that I enjoyed that atmosphere a lot. Yes. And 48, we went to Manchester for 2 years.
Yes. So you spent 2 years in Manchester where Bray and Moore were. And I think you never worked with each other. So is this because you had diverging perspective on the problem at this point already, or?
No, the whole thing, the whole initiative to go to Manchester came at a conference in Heidelberg. It was on spin glasses. Mm-hmm. Moore gave a talk on the cubic field theory of spin glasses, and I pointed out, okay, the next perturbation step, you're going to have the whole thing blowing into your face. And he decided that this was a meaningful piece of critique and then invited me right away. That's a lot about him. Yes, he mentions in his interview that Alan Bray and himself were diverted from this field theory approach because they could see how complicated the propagators were, which we derived. And I was not aware that I had such a big impact on them, but that's sure that they started to push this droplet and scaling idea in 84 after my arrival. And the atmosphere at the Manchester department was again a very special one and friendly in a totally different way. In Rome and in Saclay, people were fighting over coffee about political issues. At the British University, at least at that time, maybe Brexit had changed that, but at that time, you were not touch anything political. You were a bore if you were raising these questions. So that it took me almost half a year to figure out the probable position of the different members of the department on these issues. Because there was this coded exchange of ideas, remarks and things. This was a high art in a way. And the whole department were having lunch together, these miserable sandwiches we had. So we were meeting regularly each day for lunch and each day for tea, so that each afternoon. And so that I came to know all the people at the department, and they were using some small personal stories, some remarks on the news at the TV, that type of chit chat with an undercurrent of a conviction about larger things, but never ever going into details on those. That I found again very remarkable in its own right. And as you say, we never worked together, but we were discussing a lot. And I was trying to point out that long-range correlations in spin glasses, which were a fact, everybody was convinced about this, long-range correlations should make people extremely cautious about choosing the boundary conditions, rather than just imposing all plus on one end, all minus at the other end, and looking for this torsion exponent or whatever it's called this way, on top in a very small system, 8 cubed. So, my impression was that these are much more complicated issues, and this the presence of these long-range correlations or zero modes. This is a major enigma or a big, huge question mark in my mind ever since. You have a system with discrete symmetry, right? Z2. And that system somehow turns out to sustain soft modes, Goldstone modes. How do you understand this? What's happening to the spins when this sort of Goldstone mode is propagating across the system? Now, you have a very clear idea of what's happening to the spins in a Heisenberg spin, right? The Mognon. Slight tuning of the nearby spins. But in the spin glass, the rising spin glass, you cannot do that. You either flip or not. And this was something on which we were having a lot of discussions, whether all these Monte Carlo work, especially at the beginning of the scaling approach or droplet picture, whether it was justified or not. Also, John Zeiman, the one who gave me this advice in Trieste that you can build a life's career on glasses. John Zeiman had this funny little journal called Science Progress. He was the chief editor. And he wanted to publish a baby introduction to spin glasses. And first he asked Mike Moore, who did not feel like writing baby introductions, so that the task came to me. And I did write, the motto of Zeiman's was that write it in such a way that a biologist will understand it. So spin glasses for biologists. Good. Now, I did something, and that was, it was having an interesting fate, that little paper, because everybody in the subsequent years, everybody who was taking on a completely green student with no prior knowledge of spin glasses, everybody assigned this paper to them as a first reading, so that somehow it became a very popular paper from America to Persia. Right? So, okay. In a way, I liked England a lot. I have to tell you that I liked Italy and I liked France, Germany and England as well, so that I did not like Hungary that much. And we were even hesitating about staying on. And then there was this consideration that if we wanted our son to go to a Hungarian high school, if we wanted him to establish friendships, and the type of friendships which he established as an adolescent, then we have to move back. As it happens, my son is a professor in Chicago, and all his friendships are scattered over the globe, but okay. So we moved back in 86.
Mm-hmm. So you kept on, you've mentioned you kept on collaborating with Cyrano over the years, and you brought in also your first student into that collaboration, Tomas Temesvari, over the years. So you've already discussed how Cyrano and you were complementary in your approaches. What was Tomas's synergies in this work?
Tomas is a person who checks everything a dozen times, and he wants to make everything absolutely sure. So it's on the level of an obsession, not only being conscientious, but really someone dedicated to the last detail. If you start your research work by evaluating 75 Feynman graphs going up to 6 loops, then you have to have this sort of capacity. And these propagators were given in an implicit form, sort of definitions embedded into definitions and whatever, taking up three printed pages. And in order to derive the long wavelength behavior for the different cases, took a fantastic effort. And a large part of that effort was due to Tamás. And those efforts provided an understanding of the meaning of this. Propagators. The propagators are correlation functions and overlaps of correlation functions. Now, you see, you can have overlaps, long-range overlaps, parallel-like overlaps between valleys which are not very close related to each other, so that the overlap between the spin configurations is small. The Parisi overlap is small. And yet, the propagators overlap between those two valleys are long range. Now, how can you understand such a thing? There's violent infrared divergences coming up even between valleys which have zero overlaps between the magnetization patterns. Well, I can only offer my own understanding of this, that if you consider two pieces of literary work in the same language, two independent pieces, you translate them into binary code and whatever, and you calculate the overlap. Chances are that overlap will be small, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are two independent pieces of writing. But if you calculate the correlation functions inside both and look at the overlap between these correlation functions, they must have a long-range overlap because those texts are in the same language. And so the structure of the language will come across in a high degree of overlap between the correlation functions, but not between the patterns. This sort of picture motivated me when I was working on the chaos problem. But again, you switch on a small external field and the magnetic pattern goes away immediately and will have zero overlap with the original one. And yet, if you calculate the overlap of the correlation functions, it turns out to be long range. So this is again the same thing, the same with changing the temperature. And another thing which Neumann and Stein pointed out, this chaos in volume, chaos in the number of particles. Excuse me, let me drink.
Sure.
Well, so Tamás came in with this sort of dedication to detail. And in fact, the collaboration between Tamás and Cyrano survived my collaboration with Cyrano, because I got involved in this administration type of work, the beginning of the 90s, building up new institutions, new departments, and things like that. A lot of waste of time, I have to admit. And Tamás was clever enough to refrain from this sort of activity. And later I I went to work for a bank, and so that was a completely different type of adventure again. And steel spin glasses followed me there too.
So we'll get to that. Before, I wanted to, as you mentioned, you had a field theory program, right? This was what you pushed for.
Yes.
A decade or even a bit, yes, more. What was the reaction of the community to the field theory approach? How was this? And this was also Cyrano's program. You were jointly involved in this.
People were looking at it with some reservation, I'd say. And also with some sort of the type of respect that you earn if you are mad. So Edvard Bresen compared this whole effort to pyramid building, if you wish. Now, it was not completely fruitless. Nobody really knows whether this type of hierarchical organizational phase space is present in physical dimensions or not. I tend to believe, together with the Rome group, that it's there. Not necessarily with very high barriers, but high enough to act as impenetrable at the level of temperatures we're talking about. Now, so that I believe that this organization is there. And if this ultrametric organization is there, then we were able to derive a word identity from that. A word identity valid to any order in perturbation theory. Now, I think this is a result. This is something that at least should have an impression on people, that the structure in itself implies these long-range correlations. Mm. And in the meantime, I came to be convinced that long-range correlations are an integral part of any complex system. Because if there is any meaning I am able to assign to the slogan that a complex system is more than the sum of its parts, then it must mean that there are no finite range correlations, because otherwise the system would be able to be cut into finite size, and it would not be more than the sum of its parts. So that I think this whole spin glass story has an importance far beyond copper manganese or any laboratory spin glass. It's a framework within which to think about complex systems and their long-range correlations. And this is why I would like to understand these long-range correlations, how they emerge in the case of a discrete system. I think that this way of looking at problems has remained with me, even independent of the context of spin glasses. The last paper we published together with the Vienna group, Stefan Turner and company, was about the fragmentation of society into these opinion bubbles or whatever they are, and a possible mechanism which gives rise to this structure, and again, creating these landscapes and creating a lot of tragic consequences, as we could witness on the 6th of January.
So I'd like to draw you back still a bit in the past. In the mid-90s, in July 1996, you co-organized a summer school in Budapest on Monte Carlo techniques. As far as I know from your published work, you've never been involved in Monte Carlo simulations, but were you paying close attention? Was this something that you were involved at a distance?
I realized the importance of the approach. I was convinced about the very fruitful nature of this approach and the absolute necessity. But I also shared Sam Edwards or Mike Moore's conviction that without knowing the answer, you are in a hopeless situation if you just have numerical work at your disposal. Lev Landau also had a maxim on this, apart from Monte Carlo, that never start to try to crack a problem without knowing the answer. So, but, you know, beyond joke, it is absolutely important that you have a very good conceptual grasp of the problem. But in order to flesh it out, to make it convincing for others, you need to do either laboratory work or numerical experiments. So that this is why I decided to organize that school. And there were extremely good people giving lectures there in a crowd, Enzo Marinari and others. And it turned out to be a program well worth spending money on. At that point, it was easy for me to organize these things because I was the director of this college. That I had my own budget and I had the infrastructure. And so it was natural to embark on these tasks.
In notes that you sent us also, you mentioned that your first interest in disordered, or in glasses at least, were in structural glasses and the results that were coming out in the early 70s. And in the late 80s, there was a branch of spinning glass ideas that moved into the structural glass world through the work of Kirkpatrick, Thermalay, and Wolness. Did you pay attention to this? Or did that in any way rekindle your interest in structural glasses at that point?
No, I took a very distant interest. So I appreciated the work. I could not quite understand why one-step replica symmetry breaking was the same as mode coupling. So I was lost at a relatively early stage. But also, my own cursory meeting with the glass problem was about real glasses, like the one in the window. Right? It was the silicate glasses. Mm-hmm. And that is a different problem from these fragile objects, which people treat with Gardner's transition and this fragmentation of phase space. This is a different issue. And in a way, the real glass problem may be trivial. I am not sure. It may not be trivial, but just less understood than these fragile glasses.
So you've mentioned already a couple of occasions that you moved into more economics or econophysics in the late 90s, and that spinning glasses stayed with you. But so how influential have spinning glasses remained in your research or in your life since you've left the explicit study of spin glasses?
Absolutely. First, I realized that I got involved in Revelation because I was elected to be the chairman of the Hungarian Association of Risk Managers. And in such capacity, I got involved in the implementation of the European regulation in Hungary. And I had to study the different national implementations of those European rules in different countries like Germany, England, France. These are non-trivial things, right? So the body of the regulation was something like 40 pages of legalese, but the interpretation issued by the Bank of England was a big volume of 800 pages, explaining all the different aspects of that regulation. Right. So I had to equip myself with that knowledge because I was negotiating with the National Bank, the bank supervision, the treasury in the country. So people who did have a deep knowledge of all these legal arrangements. Now, what I could point out was that some of that regulation implied finding the grand state of stimulus. It's both non-trivial and trivial, because you know, Spinglass-like problems arise whenever you have a built-in contradiction into the structure of a problem. So if you have to optimize a portfolio, but there are elements which are positively correlated, there are some other elements that are negatively correlated, so essentially you are dealing with a Spinglass problem. And not only that, but in some other points I was able to detect built-in inconsistencies. So a regulation that has its purpose to avoid regulatory arbitrage, so to give the chance to a bank to game the regulation, and in this effort to avoid this, they are building in bylaws and other little rules, which leads to a regulatory arbitrage, to the breakdown in convexity and that sort of thing. So that, and I made some friends in different central banks in Europe and also in the US, the Federal Reserve. I was telling them about that. Mind you, at a certain point, I was even given an audience by the chairman of the banking supervision of the Senate. So that and I explained to him that there is this piece of international regulation that is inspiring banks to have regulatory arbitrage. And these pieces should be avoided in the next edition of the same rules. He looked at me and said, "My friend, financial regulation is like sausage making. Once you've seen how it is done, you would not touch the subject." Well, so that was the achievement I was able to in that field. Nevertheless, I had these very interesting experiences with these people. Those people are not stupid at all. So those officials working for the Federal Reserve in Washington, those are absolutely brilliant people, well equipped in mathematics and that, first rate. But they are working under suffocating political constraints. And the outcome is a sausage. So you prepare the legislation to the best of our knowledge to be consistent and without internal contradictions, etc. And then that goes in front of the decision makers, and the decision makers are representing different interests, different national interests or business interests, etc. And they are starting to screw up your regulation. And however nicely you thought it out, you end up with something which is full of internal contradictions. This was what I learned. Mm-hmm. I also made, yes.
Oh, no, no, no. So, I was going to change topic. So if you...
sure. Let's change topic.
Okay. So we're... So Cyrano co-authored a book actually on random field and spin glasses in the early 2000s. And at that point, you had stopped collaborating because you had taken up this new branch. Was it a consideration for you to write this book with him, or did this?
No. It had a personal aspect to it. As I told you, Cyrano was convicted leftist, a deep conviction left. And he regarded banks in the spirit of Bertolt Brecht. So that establishing a bank is worse than robbing a bank, that type of. So that he regarded my signing up for the bank as some sort of a treason. Mm-hmm. I was selling myself out and leaving science behind. Well, emotionally, I could understand that. Of course, I was not happy, especially not happy because all my efforts, both in the bank and outside the bank, was focused on making the bloody system more stable. So that at the bank, I was having infinite fights with the colleagues whose bonuses I was reducing by my objection to their grand ideas. So I had veto power and I was using it, and everybody got a smaller envelope as a result. Now, you can imagine that this is a conflict-laden position, right? And in fact, I paid with some hard trouble, etc. But Cyrano was not able to see that in that light. This was just, you know, daylight robbing. Mm-hmm. And
so during your time and as an academician, right, at Edwards and elsewhere, did you ever get to teach part of a course on replica symmetry breaking or the replica trick? And if yes, could yes. you?
Yes. I started doing that, I think, in 98 or sometime like that.
1998.
Okay. And I kept that course running up until the end of my employment with the Tush University, which came to an end in 2011. Now, that was that was a special course, the optional for the students. But you could earn credit points on it. So it was part of the curriculum, but it was elective. Now, you may ask what my experience was with students in those courses. They regarded as some kind of an exotic excursion into something which was half crazy, half challenging, but I did have students whom I could teach how to apply replicas in a creative manner, so that I had a series of students. So my description of the situation is such that, of course, the replica approach is not ordinary mathematics. There's no doubt about it. Nevertheless, you can formulate it in such a way that it sounds rational, right? So if you are willing to give up your addiction to mathematical axioms, and if you are able to somehow liberate yourself and have a fantasy or whatever, then it can even be amusing in a way. So that I have a number of students who were using this and who are using this technique ever since. Some of them working for MSCI, another one working for the European Central Bank. So, you know, replicas are spreading over over finance.
So is there anything else you'd like to share with us about this epoch and about this era that we might have missed along the way?
Well, I think it is a remarkable episode in the story of statistical physics, because of the reason I was trying to describe, because of this extremely imaginative and creative use of mathematics and this attitude to mathematics. And from this point of view, it is not interesting that remarkably, Michel Talleyrand and Francesco Guerra were able to derive the results within the framework of consolidated real probability theory. Now, you see, if you look back at this, the story of statistical physics as it started, Ludwig Boltzmann, ergodicity was at the core. It was the first major stumbling block. And it was a highly non-trivial problem that gave rise to a chapter in mathematics, etc. Right? Now, compared with the importance of the ergodicity question, it is already remarkable that phase transitions were possible to be inserted into the framework of statistical physics. And you have broken ergodicity in a phase transition. And how people figured out how they are able to mimic the ergodic process by adding this infinitesimal external field, etc. That is very remarkable. Now, you take one more step and you find non-ergodicity in an extremely complicated pattern in a field where you do not have this crutch of the of the ordering field. So there is no external field that would mimic. And even if there were at zero temperature, it would not be much of an advantage because of this chaos property. So that the fact that statistical physics was able to survive these challenges, this I find extremely remarkable. It's a fantastic advance along these lines.
Did you follow the work of Guerra and Talleyrand, the mathematical physics and the probabilistic work as it was happening, or this is a retrospective view?
No. Well, I think I am able to understand what Guerra did. Michel Talleyrand is way above my head. And although I am using replicas even now, I am in using replica symmetry breaking occasionally, but I never had this urge to build it on the solid basis of. So I'm quite happy with this heuristic use of it. I always have people who are able to run Monte Carlo simulations and find the numerical evidence so that I could just claim that I had a dream and this is the formula I dreamed up and forgetting about replicas. And those formulae are extremely non-trivial, I have to tell you, so that within the finance context, you may have 6 or 8 different order parameters. And so it's a non-trivial structure. Nevertheless, it leads you to the replicas, lead you to these non-trivial predictions, which are borne out by simulations. In some cases, even by exact mathematics. So
in closing, have you by any chance kept notes, correspondence, papers from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Well, I'm pretty sure that we do not have too many documents left. We moved house more than once. And whatever I have left is in the garage, in folders which number something like 150, which are collecting dust. What I can promise is that if I find something, such as the letters from Cyrano.
Or with Giorgio. Or your correspondence from the 70s or so.
Yeah, sure. Simancic letter, for example. It would be a great tribute to his memory. He's a great person he was. So if I find any such document, I will be happy to deposit it. But I, right at the moment, I do not have
much hope.
Maybe some hope, but certainly no tangible document at the moment.
Thank you very much for your time and for this conversation.
It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure, and listening to some of the previous interviews, I came to see how important these are. Not mine, my contribution, but people like Bernard Derrida or Edouard Brezin or Taules or Mike Moore. These are important players. And it's an interesting story how this replica symmetry breaking thing came about and how it went on to inseminate countless different disciplines. If you manage to catch Giorgio, please try to get him to give an account of how on earth he got this idea.
We will. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I promise.